And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 26 in the new year.
Can we just be 2.1 or, you know, like
we could start over. It would be this would be episode 1, season 2.
So it'd be one. So actually it would, if you do it like a television series, it would be 201.
Matt 2.0.
Sure. So we could do all of this. Sarah Michelle Fetters joins us, Brian Zitzelman, and Mike Ward. All familiar voices here on the podcast. I am Adam Gerke, and we are some of Seattle's film critics. Brian, Mike, go ahead and say
Come
hello.
Come on, Mike, say hello.
Come on, say hello.
Get on closer.
Okay.
Hi.
There you go.
Hey, Mike and I are sharing a mic. Mike and I are sharing a mic.
New studios for us we'll be sullying these new studios here. So, but we are some of Seattle's film critics. We gather in movie theaters every week, several times. We watch films, we discuss films, and now we bring the discussion that we have about those films to you in podcast form. So that's what we're doing here tonight. We've got a lot to get through, a number of films that came out this year. And maybe we'll dip into some that came out last year as well, because it's so right on the heels of 2015.
Oscars, and we're talking Oscars. Come on,
Oscars.
Come on.
That important thing, Golden Globes, and also something that falls right into Mike's wheelhouse, the Seattle Film Awards, which we've got all the latest data and input on that.
Didn't we bring up the Seattle Film Awards last year with a hint that maybe something bigger was going to happen?
Yeah, I think there was that possibility.
We did. I do remember this. Yeah.
And is that something bigger actually happening?
I mean, we could talk about that a little bit. I don't know.
All right, the stage. Let's talk about movies first.
Let's see where we can go with this. Sure. So 13 Hours, Mike, while we're on the topic, we've all had a chance to see this. Tell us a little bit about 13 Hours.
Well, I think 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, can be summed up as the Michael Bay movie about the Benghazi attacks in September 2012.
And this was in Libya. We need to
remind
folks. Yes, correct.
In Libya, on September 11th, carrying over to September 12th, 2012.
Sure.
Discuss.
And so, things blow up. Here's the thing about it. So Michael Bay, is the master of all things boom. Right.
When you say master, does that imply quality or is that just usage?
He's had his moments.
He's been very, you know, John Woo does things that are very poetic when he has things blow up. Michael Bay just makes things blow up.
John Woo's a better filmmaker.
Agreed.
Okay. He is a filmmaker.
Yeah. I like The Rock. I think The Rock is a legitimately good movie. I enjoy Bad Boys, and I actually like Armageddon.
But some people might be in college.
Let's remember, though, The Rock was nearly 20 years ago.
Yes, I know.
So, I mean, let's be fair.
I know. I get it.
How many wins does he get, you know, in a decade? I don't know.
He hasn't had any. The last movie that Michael Bay made where I actually thought he was trying to do something different and making an effort was The Island.
And that Pain and Gain?
And that was over a decade
ago. Pain and Gain was something a little different, a little bad, but different.
Yeah, but he wasn't the right guy to make that movie.
Okay. So the thing about 13 Hours is lots blows up.
Yes.
But there's very little brought up about the actual politics behind this. I mean, there's like 30-second little, here's what's happening in Libya. But Sarah, you and I were talking last night, and you mentioned something to me that there's actually a little more going on politically here that Bay is bringing to the table.
Whether he means to or not.
Right, and tell us what that is.
Well, and I think Michael will probably take this even a step further than I will. I'm almost positive about that.
Oh, boy.
So if you've read the memoir written by Mitchell Zukov, it's based on a bunch of the military contractors who were there in Benghazi, who were the ones that essentially saved all of the American lives.
Yes.
It's a good book. It is as apolitical as I think these contractors wanted it to be.
Okay.
Yes, there are, you know, you could read certain things into it like any of us will. And anybody, no matter what your political persuasion is, you're going to bring that into the film with you. Michael Bay, I think, has attempted to make an apolitical movie. He wants to make his Black Hawk Down. He wants to make his Zero Dark Thirty. He wants to make his Hurt Locker. He even wants to make his Lone Survivor, which is not quite as apolitical as I think Peter Berg intended, but pretty close.
Okay.
Michael Bay, though, almost can't help himself.
Right.
And there are little things throughout this movie where you know which way he is leaning and what he is trying to do. You have images of a bunch of Muslims on their call to prayer. But instead of just having that moment and letting that moment be what it is, he chooses to focus the camera on a bunch of AK-47s sitting right in the center of the frame.
And it's not just that. It's that the camera is sort of tucked back away, peering around a corner, looking through a very narrow, like you're spying on these.
Yes.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
But the whole presentation is like that in that he wants to create a sense of otherness to the attackers there. A faceless, almost a zombie horde mentality.
Sure. And I mean, there is a part that is called Zombieland.
Yes, but there was a place compound that was called Zombieland.
And he took it literally,
which
was nice.
But he takes it literally. Yeah. You are going to bring your own political ethos to this film, no matter who you are, whether you mean to or not.
Sure.
Michael Bay does as well. It does lean a little bit more towards the right of the spectrum than he probably intends it to.
You know, see, here's the interesting thing from this that I noticed. I have relatives who are Republicans and relatives that are Democrats. The relatives who are Democrats saw this and thought, wow, this is really just a big show of force, arms, guns, blazing, shoot them up. The Republicans turned around and immediately said, that's it, I'm never voting Democratic ever again, and here's why, this movie makes a lot of sense. And if my relatives are hearing this and they, you know... I'm in trouble now. But what I'm saying is that
the movie never says any
It never says any of that, yet it is still so polarizing to audiences. And I think that's really interesting.
Well, you do have Ted Nugent, who said that after seeing the film, both President Obama and Hillary Clinton should be found guilty of treason and then hung.
Mm.
So you've got that perspective.
Which the movie never actually mentions Hillary Clinton's name ever.
And it doesn't.
And Obama is mentioned in praise.
Right. However, they don't need to mention them because there's a character called the Chief, and the Chief is
Bob.
And the Chief is this sort of bumbling sort of stand-in for Hillary and Obama, if you see it that particular way. But what you get with the Chief is a guy who can't make a decision, and he's the guy who, you know, orders the stand-down that everybody's talking about is so controversial. But he is the figurehead for the government. And so when he's bumbling around and not able to make a decision and telling somebody to do something and being shot down, you know, not shot down, but shouted down, he looks like an idiot.
And let's be clear, he is the CIA station chief at this secret facility, which isn't so secret.
Right.
That the contractors are stationed at.
Sure.
They are not actually stationed at the ambassador compound.
Right.
They are stationed with the CIA in their secret compound.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't need to say their names because there's the physical representation. And so, you know, again, it's how you perceive the situation. And I think the film, Michael Bay does try. You know, we've got the soft focus lens of John Krasinski with his family, and we've got the slow sort of build up to the, you know, heading out for the conflict to report and deploy, but he can't help himself. He turns the thing into, he's got car chases, as you mentioned, with the big booms, and he's got infrared visuals of heads exploding when they get shot with a gun, and he turns the whole thing into like a video game. And I did say to a lot of people that I talked to and in my review that I would really deep down want to know what these heroes think of this depiction of their story, because I have to think, at some point when they, you know, when he Michael Bays it up, they have to wonder, I guess, but it's not really exactly how I want it represented.
It is funny from an action standpoint. It's the best Michael Bay has been since, of all things, Pearl Harbor. And Pearl Harbor, but Pearl Harbor is a piece of crap. But one has to admit that the actual attack on Pearl Harbor in that movie is as a piece of action filmmaking, it's glorious. The problem with the sequence is that he takes this tragic, horrible attack and turns it into a Star Wars-esque action sequence. And he does that here again with this film. Things from a technical standpoint, from an action standpoint, they're amazing.
Sure.
But tonally, you're like, wait, this is almost more Mission in Action with Chuck Norris going and decapitating,
but
faceless bad guys in Vietnam, than it is an actual political point about anything.
Yeah, so action, politics aside, I found this emotionally pretty vapid. What are your thoughts on that?
I can't really go there because, I mean, it follows an old, tried and true melodramatic war movie playbook as far as the soldiers are concerned. It plays all of those emotions very broadly, very larger than life, and very predictably. But I think it works for the sake of the material. And I think both John Krasinski and James Badge Dale are both very – who play two of the contractors and the two primary contracts that we spend most of the time with. I think they're both exceptional in the film.
Sure. Mike?
The emotions for me are hard to find.
Yeah.
In the film.
Right.
You know, I went home and I revisited the story and I looked at different news stories and I caught myself getting more swept up in that situation again, reading about the accounts and looking at what happened here. I think the emotions for me anyway were snuffed out by all of the trickery and the film magic that Michael Bay throws at this thing that cheapens the emotions that I'm looking for, even though Krasinski, like Sarah mentions, does have like an emotional arc that almost as close as it can in a Michael Bay film pays off.
Right, yeah, because I mean there are some pivotal characters here, spoiler, who don't make it out of this.
Well, we know four characters are going to die.
We do, but when that happens, I could care less. I was kind of like, oh well. So there you go. So, but theater enter skip. Mike, where are you sitting on this?
Well, I can't tell 50% of America not to see it. So, theater. Okay. Just see it for yourself.
What, really?
You know what? And here's why I'll say that.
Wow.
Go see it and make up your own mind. Because
I like that, though.
That's the best way to see something like this.
Okay.
You know what? You're making me almost rethink of what I was going to say because I really like the way that you just put that.
And I personally gave it a star and a half.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, so in my review, I gave it 2 out of 4 stars. I think it's Bay's best attempt at making a real movie in ages. I do think it's a rent.
Okay.
I think it's got enough in it that makes it worth seeing. But I hear exactly what Mike is saying. It's like, this is one of those films, this is one of those times where you almost do need to see it just to make up your own mind.
Sure.
But I'm not sure the filmmaking's good enough for you to rethink whatever your prior opinion is.
Right. And I'm going to back you on that. I'll take you one step with that as well. Say, Mike, I agree with you. People need to see it and make their own mind. I don't think they should pay full price, so I'm going rental on it as well. So, ta-da, ta-da, ta-da. Fifth Wave. Sarah, big Fifth Wave on this. Tell us a little bit about Fifth Wave. This is the new one that's out this week as well. Keeping up on that.
What's interesting about the Fifth Wave is that, so we have three big movies, three potentially huge movies that are opening this weekend, and this is the only one that the studios decided to screen for us.
Yeah.
Not Dirty Grandpa with Zac Efron and Robert De Niro.
Show us the grandpa.
I know, right?
He's dirty.
Not The Boy with the creepy plastic
whatever,
the evil doll movie. They show us the young adult fiction potential trilogy starter, The Fifth Wave, with Chloe Grace Moretz. I have never read Rick Yancey's book that The Fifth Wave is based on.
Yeah,
I have seen Jay Blakeson's prior film, which is The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which is fantastic. Watch it. It's great.
A little dark.
A little dark, but it's really wonderful. This movie does not change the dystopian young adult fiction landscape in any way whatsoever.
Right.
It takes Independence Day, The Hunger Games, and Maze Runner, and probably Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It takes those movies and puts them into one big jumbled mess.
No Cirque de Freak?
No Cirque de Freak. basically, you have an alien invasion. Chloe Grace Moretz is your typical American teenager. She watches the world crumble around her.
No, it's
And she survives.
And she survives.
That's even
along
more terrible.
She survives along with her little brother. They get separated when the military arrives to take them off to safety. And she is going to do whatever it takes to get back to her little brother and save him.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff is actually not too bad.
But wait,
The depiction of the world going into chaos and falling apart,
but wait,
pretty
more.
Good.
Yeah.
Them getting separated, fine. Her going off on her own, fine.
But wait.
Then the real movie kicks in.
There's a twist.
Yeah.
What a twist.
Well,
a twist.
There's a lot of
secretly crocodiles.
But there's a lot of twists. What ends up happening, two parallel stories suddenly take shape at this point. One is with Chloe Grace Moretz, and she hooks up with this really sexy, hunky ex-MIT.
Yes, she does.
College student to go save the brother.
Uh-huh.
And the other one involves Liev Schreiber as this creepy army colonel who has taken all of the children and is going to turn them into child soldiers to battle the alien hordes.
Mike, you don't like the sound of this. I see your reaction to Schreiber's involvement.
I have the ability of looking at Adam and Sarah and Brian and watching you guys talk about this, and I'm having the time of my life over here.
Setup is fine.
Uh-huh.
The execution, the moment these two parallel storylines start, it is bad. It gets a little worse, and then it becomes kind of incredibly awesome in how terrible it actually is.
Right.
Nice. It achieves a level of hysterical mediocrity mm-hmm. that had our preview audience in unintentional stitches.
Mr. Gerke, right. Do you agree with this?
I do, as a matter of fact. And there was actually, Sarah and I had the discussion afterwards, too, that there is a lot of violence in this film.
Oh, good gosh, yes.
Yet it only achieves a PG-13 rating.
Is there blood?
No.
A droplet.
There's your answer
but
right there.
But the implied violence is so over the top at times, you're seeing an entire 747 crashing into the ground and flames blasting out of this.
World War Z was PG-13.
Yeah. Yet there are other films that are coming out very soon that are tremendously, equally gory, but you actually see the blood, and that's rated R.
Were there boobs in it? If they showed the boobs?
No boobs.
Okay.
Well, one thing I pointed out to Adam is it's amazing how far we've actually come as far as being allowed to depict this kind of violence, especially as it relates to children since the Hunger Games. People were up in arms about the Hunger Games, about how it was kids, you know, battling kids and kids killing kids. You actually almost see nothing in that movie.
Right.
I mean, which obviously then makes Rue's death all the more potent, is because hers is really the only one you witness, and even that is cleverly shot.
Yes.
Let's just put it that way. In this movie, you see what is at his oldest is maybe a 12 or 13 year old kid
get
shot right through the torso. I mean,
and that is
and it's
pretty visual
in the center of the frame, out of nowhere.
Yeah,
the bullet goes right through the person.
Yep.
There's no blood at all.
There's a little spatter.
No, I mean, but the spatter is like black. It looks like it's just his uniform.
Maybe a paintball.
Yeah.
Paintball. Are you sure it wasn't a paintball? Is that the twist?
That is this movie. It's craziness. Mm-hmm. How violent this film is at times.
Yeah. And also emotionally vapid.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So Sarah.
But everybody in it's really good,
which is weird.
I mean, again, you've got so much young talent. You've got Chloe Grace Moretz. You've got Micah Monroe from It Follows. You've got so much great talent in this film, and yet the movie is hysterically horrible.
Yeah. So where are you sitting on it?
Well, it's a skip, but I kind of really want people to watch it when it gets to home video so they can see just how funny
and
it is.
And I'm with the skip as well. I'm saying wait for it. It'll appear on Sci-Fi in like a week, and then you can watch it there, and it'll fit right in with the whole...
It's going to make a great double bill with The Host later on.
Yeah.
Oh, so, Jesus Christ.
That brings us to one of the films that was actually... It got an Oscar nod for animation. This is Anomalisa, which is a film about a man who's... I don't know how to best describe him. He's sort of like a coach for...
He's a self-help guru.
Right. And so his name is Michael Stone. By the way, he's a foam little character, mostly foam. Michael Stone, his voice is voiced by David Thewlis.
Thewlis.
So Michael Stone is voiced by David Thewlis, and everybody else in the entire film, except one, is voiced by Tom Noonan.
Love Noonan.
So,
who's genius
in this. He voices every other character from the bellhops to the stewardesses to the, you know, waitresses.
Save one key exception.
Who is a love interest who comes into Michael Stone's life, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. And that would be a character named Lisa, who becomes an anomaly, Anomalisa. And so we see Michael's... trying to step out of his life, trying to right his wrongs, but ultimately falling back into his old life. And it's kind of it's a semi-arcless story.
And who wrote this movie?
Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
Basically, he's the man behind this. So he's also the director on this, along with Duke Johnson. They've put together, as we see, this animated...
stop-motion animated film that very easily could have been Team America World Police and instead become something poignant... emotional, profound, and incredibly deep.
Is it as funny as Team America?
Not
at times, but in a different way. I mean, it's as funny as it's a Charlie Kaufman. So originally, this is a 2005 audio play that Charlie Kaufman wrote and never thought was going to do anything more than be performed once by these three actors, along with composer Carter Burwell, on a stage, and that was supposed to be it. Duke Johnson came to him a decade later and said, let's make an animated movie.
And for those unfamiliar with Charlie Kaufman, that's kind of one of those, there's not a lot of writers, screenwriters' names that people know. You know your Tarantinos. Kaufman is the writer of the really weird movies that everybody likes from the past two decades.
Yes.
Bing John Malkovich.
Malkovich.
Your Synecdoche, New York. Your Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Adaptation.
He does the strange things, which are quite often great. So my question for you guys is this great?
I hesitate on great. Mike, I see you nodding yes, though.
I acknowledge it's a tough sit, you know, to the people that maybe not expecting sort of how dark and, you know, even dark and comic beats it has, and then eventually how it wraps up. I'll leave that there. I was mesmerized by the whole thing. I thought it was incredible, and it just missed my top 10 of 2015. And I will say this. It is a movie that if anybody has ever struggled with self-esteem issues, depression, sort of that where do I sit in the world?
Commitment, relationships,
well, any
parenthood.
Of those things. This movie will strike a chord really, really close to home.
Oh, sure.
And it did with me, and I was not expecting that at all. I saw, you know, the character, he's kind of this, you know, you can sort of see why he may be lonely in life. And up until the point where he meets Lisa, the whole thing has this subtle shift over the course of about 75 of its 90 minutes until, again, it devolves into a third act that's crazy. But there is a subtle shift in how you can take your personal experiences, if you've been touched by these things, and relay it to not necessarily what's happening on screen, but the decisions, the mannerisms. It almost becomes more human than really a lot of animated films I've seen in a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And here's what I'll say is I kind of in some ways regret the review that I wrote for it. Initially when I watched the movie, I liked the movie. I was impressed with the movie from a technical standpoint. I was blown away by Tom Noonan's performance. I think Tom Noonan is genius in this movie. What he's able to do is just mind-blowing. But a lot of the emotion, a lot of the emotional dramatics left me a little bit bewildered. But what I discovered, and this happens a lot with Charlie Kaufman, and I should not have been surprised by this, I couldn't get any of them out of my head. And I keep pondering them, I keep thinking about them, I keep mulling them. And now I look at the review that I wrote back at the beginning of December, and I'm like, gosh, that would I'd give that a much higher rating now because of how it's sitting with me, because of what I'm thinking of and pondering and putting through my psychosis, my own internal psychotic episodes now.
And I would say I'm kind of in the in the Mike camp here, where a lot of it does resonate with me as the human experience.
I
don't know if that makes it great, but it certainly does make me go, huh, now that's a thing. That is making me think. And Sarah, you're right. This does resonate and it does stick with you and it does. But I see this coming from more of almost like a Kafka standpoint of view.
Sure.
Where it's nobody turns into a bug, but but there is a whole sequence where you kind of go, huh, how about that? This is where you know where he's realizing the mask that he's wearing in some regards.
Right, right.
So,
the approach too with the three voices through the entire movie, and you're right, Noonan is the voice of any children, any women, any men, any exterior characters, and it's all, for the most part, spoken the exact same way. And it just creates this world of just sameness, and you know, you want to shut it out, but it's always there. Kaufman is, we just don't get him enough, and this was great.
Just a little thing, you bring up Tom Noonan. So when they did this, they recorded it like they did the play. They did it all three together, all at once. I mean, think about that. Tom Noonan didn't just play all of these characters. He played them all at one time in one sitting as if it were a play with the other two actors working with him.
Yeah.
Five more seconds. Thank goodness we have Kickstarter, because if we didn't have Kickstarter and Duke Johnson selling this to Charlie Kaufman to go there, we wouldn't have the movie.
Sure. So theater, rent, skip. Mike?
Theater.
Theater for you. Sarah?
Theater.
Okay. And I'm more of on the rental camp. I thought it was technically spectacular, but just not in love with it as much as you two.
Oh. So,
there we go. You know what also happened, though? In our hiatus, Golden Globes happened. Did anyone pay attention?
Not
briefly.
Really. I mean, briefly.
It's fun to tweet about.
The Golden Globes are, you know, they're fun to watch, and they're good for a laugh or two. Although I will say this year it was interesting in that this year they had and like last year, they had a 20-second delay for the live broadcast.
Sure needed it.
And I think at this point the performers And I'm going to call them performers because when they're all accepting their awards at this point, they're performing.
Yeah.
And I think Ricky Gervais, who hosted, they all knew they were on a 20-second delay.
Yeah.
And so they were more uncouth, ribald, and vulgar than they've ever been. But we wouldn't know it because large swaths of whatever it was they were saying were
I take real issue with this. I think this really speaks to the disrespect to the Golden Globes that the actors are showing specifically by doing this, because you will not catch an actor dropping an F-bomb in the middle of the Oscars.
Yeah, but they booze them up, and the Golden Globes have doubled down on the notion that they are kind of
the laughing stock.
They hired Ricky Gervais's shtick before he was the host was, "You are crappy. This show is worthless. These awards mean nothing."
Yeah.
Keep in mind, they greenlighted his monologue.
Yeah.
Which was nothing but a trashing of the Hollywood foreign press.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind is, so the Globes can in some ways influence who will win an Oscar, but they have absolutely no influence whatsoever on who gets nominated for an Oscar.
Which I disagree with strongly.
The voting was done. The voting all happened. The voting for those nominations all happened before this before these winners were even announced.
Winners is not the thing.
Oh.
We're going to get into the Oscars soon, and a lot of it has to do with conversation and when are you in the conversation? Not for wins, but to be considered a movie that's worth nominating. If you have stuff like Fury Road gets no nominations, if George Miller gets no nominations at any of these things, then they are going, why are we even putting him in this ballot of stuff to look at? I mean, we always find out Oscar voters don't watch stuff till the end. If Creed gets a Best Picture nomination, Michael B. Jordan gets an actor nomination, Coogler gets a director nomination, not wins, nominations, more people put them up the ballot. If they see Stallone's nominated, they go, oh, it's for Stallone. It's like a
old man thing. Kind of getting that inertia, and it moves it along.
No, I agree. I agree with your point on some of that the wins matter, and who wins the Oscar is one thing. But who gets nominated,
I think it really affects a different thing,
because it's same with the SAG and all this. If Cranston doesn't get a Golden Globe nom, if he doesn't get a SAG nom, is he getting an Oscar nom?
Historically.
Maybe not. But if he's got none of those?
Historically, the SAG noms, the PGA noms, the BAFTA noms, those mean a heck of a lot more to Oscar voters than a Golden Globe ever does.
Okay.
Again, with the Golden Globes, you're dealing with, what, 90 journalists?
92.
92 journalists. Boom. Hey, Mike.
Tell us about this, Mike. why is 92 important?
Why is that a good number to know?
Well, you forgot to mention that it's a hovel of 92 people all in Los Angeles.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's all it is.
They want to have their party.
Sure.
I assume we're going to mention a little something I was a part of.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Everyone was a part of here.
Yes.
pardon me, strike the I. There's no I in this. The Seattle Film Awards, which is an informal poll.
But how many
film critics?
How many of them?
32.
32.
Now,
34 invited, 32 took part.
Which is an amazing number in and of itself.
It's better than a presidential election.
Percentage-wise, that is very true. So here's my next question, though. So the Seattle Film Awards, and we brought this up at the beginning of the show, is we are now in the process of maybe trying to put together an actual Seattle Film Critics Society. In your research, what have you discovered about how many accredited press people are in Seattle who could potentially be a part of that society?
Anywhere from 85 to 95.
So
potentially.
The same amount.
Can we get Tatum?
No, right?
I see where you're going with this. We'll get C-Tate to come out and dance.
Wait, Jenna Dewan Tatum or Channing Tatum? Or we'll just get both.
Can we get both?
They're both a party.
Yeah.
So you're saying basically we have enough votes in Seattle alone that we could create our own award ceremony, we can't call it the Silver Space Needle because that's already taken. But something.
Carl Spence might come back to our show.
Sure. How about the Golden Fish Award or something? I don't know.
The Zitzelman Award.
The Flying Fish.
The Flying Fish. There you go.
So we could create our own if we had a budget and maybe get some
Does anyone here know Dick Clark Productions? Because I think that's just the step. You get the TV contract and then you're ready to go.
Huh.
Seriously, though. So we did this informal poll again this year. You said you invited 34 critics.
Yeah.
What did Seattle actually vote for?
Let's tell us what happened. What are your findings?
Because our findings are a lot more interesting than I think some of these Oscar nominations
were. So this is the third year that we've done an informal poll, or that I've sort of I will say I spearheaded kind of just reaching out to people.
Sure. You do a lot of the work.
And we, you know, we've grown from like, I think 17 people to 25 and then this year 32. Mm-hmm. And there was a process where they sent in their nominations. They went through all 21 categories, ranking 5 or 10, depending. Those were tabulated, sent back out, and then they voted. And
big winner.
Have you guys heard of a movie called Fury, Max Fury? What is it called?
I think the person standing to your left Road? Will have something to say
yeah,
to this.
Yeah, Fury Road, baby.
This happens to be Mr. Zitzelman's like number one.
Co-number one.
Like, it's practically of all time. Practically.
All time, no. Not
sure
all time,
seems
no.
like
it's,
it.
It's a great movie.
Wait, okay. Am I standing in the presence of the guy who did the tie for number one?
Yeah,
because,
you did.
Oh my gosh.
Tie.
Yes, Mad Max Fury Road was far and away Seattle's favorite. It won. It was nominated 11 times. It won 10, whatever we're going to call 10 of these
Zitzelmans.
Things.
Zitzelmans.
Unless Zitzelmans' favorites don't win, then it's a Gherky or a Fetters or whatever.
Sure.
So we had 10 wins for Mad Max, and then everything else that happened to win won once. Mm-hmm. And so some of those wins include Spotlight winning Best Ensemble Cast. We had Benicio del Toro win Best Supporting Actor for Sicario. Mm-hmm. He missed an Oscar nomination.
He's
a lot of
white.
People were surprised by that. Mm-hmm. Settle down. Nina Haas won Best Actress for a German film called Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
She's not in the conversation for Oscar. Leonardo DiCaprio won for The Revenant for Best Actor, second time in 3 years.
Okay.
And George Miller wins Best Director for Mad Max. And
hey, but what about that Best Supporting Actress
I'm getting
win?
There.
That is amazing on Seattle's part.
And then, yeah, well, and then we'll do that now. So Maya Taylor, of a film called Tangerine, mm-hmm. wins Best Supporting Actress. She's nominated for a Spirit Award. She's a transgender female playing a transgender prostitute along with Katana Kiki Rodriguez. They had two of the great breakout performances of the year. And us, and I looked, I was meaning to look it up. There's only one other city that named her a supporting actress winner. Hmm. Seattle and whoever they were, and I apologize, I don't know that. But Maya Taylor wins over Jennifer Jason Leigh, Kristen Stewart, Alicia Vikander, Kate Winslet. So
that's a tough
and it's heat. And it's an awesome win because yeah. that performance is really something you're going to remember if you see the film.
Sure, sure.
And then that Max thing won Best Picture.
Sure. So Mad Max being the big, huge takeaway, though, for us.
Yeah, if you can think of a technical part of a movie, mm-hmm. Mad Max won it.
Score.
Cinematography, costumes, production design.
All of that.
Visual effects, sound.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Inside Out won animated feature, too.
Okay, wow. And so how does this translate into Oscar land, though, for us?
Oh, we're totally influential, right, guys? Right?
Totally.
We have the influence. There is crossover, as there always is. There's the movies that rise to the top, whether it's because they're the best or they're the most talked about. And, you know, DiCaprio is the front runner for the Oscar this year.
Yeah, The Revenant got 12 nominations. Yeah. Mad Max got 10 nominations. Spotlight and The Big Short are probably the next two that should be talked about with like 6 and 5 nominations. The Martian got 7 nominations. I think one of the bigger shocks, and this is the one that's going to depress Zitzelman here,
and me, Mr. Ward.
Is Carol got 6 nominations, 3 of them very high-profile nominations for actress, supporting actress, and script, but it did not get nominated for Best Director
very
or Best Picture.
Very strange.
That was a little bit of a strange one. That was a little bit of a surprise. There were 8 Best Picture nominations out of a potential 10. Straight Outta Compton did not get nominated for Best Picture. Creed did not get nominated for Best Picture. There were movies that people, Star Wars did not get nominated for Best Picture. There were a lot of films that were in that consideration that didn't happen. But it is interesting this year that I think it's a very wide open race in a lot of ways for many of these categories. It's also the second time in 2 years that we're dealing with the Oscars so white hashtag again.
Yeah.
In all 20 of the actors, all of whom are deserving. I actually don't have a problem with any of the nominees,
right.
But it is the second time in 2 years that all 20 of the acting nominees are Caucasian.
And it's a little strange because you have people on there. Michael B. Jordan not being nominated is not what I would call a shock, just because it's the 7th film in a series, all that kind of stuff.
But
when you
Samuel
have someone like
Jackson.
Sure, and when you have someone like Samuel L. Jackson for Hateful Eight, which obviously got seen and got its not a ton of nominations, but got some, and they love to give it to villains. Mm-hmm. Villains get the supporting actor stuff, and I know some people tend to think the supporting actors and supporting actors don't mean the same, but they're good, and they've won a ton. And Del Toro's won before, and he plays not a villain, but a
It's a dark character.
A dark character, and you have Idris Elba for Beasts of No Nation, who's definitely playing a dark, villainous character and
which
that kind
I
of
called,
stuff.
By the way, I said that wasn't going to happen because of the Netflix thing. Well, and I still Netflix, stand by it's the Netflix thing. It's
could
because
be.
It was on television, and when you're dealing with a an academy that has so many of working film actors and film executives, they don't want to give it to something that was primarily seen on television.
Yeah, and I'm not shocked that like Straight Outta Compton didn't get a Best Picture nomination, but we've seen a long history of Oscars. I mean, I know people like talk about they give people with mental illness or who are dying or have cancer awards. They love to give awards to musicians. And I know, mm-hmm. Mike, there was a musician performance or a performance of a person who played a musician, Straight Outta Compton, that you particularly loved. What was that actor's name?
Oh, Jason Mitchell.
Yeah.
The heart of Straight Outta Compton, who played Eazy-E, mm-hmm. Eric Wright. Movie beautifully tells his story. You may take some quibble over what it does with the actual NWA story, but he is terrific, and he had traction for a while in the race.
Did.
Straight Outta Compton, by the way, I just say this. It hit... there's Oscar prognosticators that are like, you know, March Madness college basketball tournament people,
sure,
right?
Sure.
They sit there and they tick this box and that box and they run the percentages and the analytics. And
you can Nate Silver the Oscars
exactly.
all you want, and it's
and
possible.
And Straight Outta Compton hit most every metric
Everyone.
Going down the board.
Sure.
You know, it got this nomination and that nomination. And yet, it's not here. Jason Mitchell's not here. The screenplay.
What's the irony? The irony. This is the best part.
Which is written by four Caucasians. Gets nominated. Okay, fine. It's recognized.
And it's a great script.
But the rumors in Hollywood,
it's not a great script.
The rumors in Hollywood are that this movie sat until an original script got tossed and these people were brought in to polish and rewrite and get the credit.
Interesting.
So now when you start thinking, okay, well, Compton didn't get made until a white script came into, you know, it just starts getting into this murkiness of stuff that, you know, the Oscars don't really want to deal with, but now is in their laps for a whole nother podcast worth of reasons we
sure.
can talk
well,
about.
I mean, and we'll have a podcast, I think, dedicated to doing our own predictions for the Oscars in a couple weeks. Oscars aren't until February 28th, and so we'll have plenty of time to come up with our own theories and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious. You know, because we are running out of time and we don't want to dig too deeply into this right now. But just throwing the spit shots out there, anybody have a front runner that you're thinking is going to win Best Picture right now? Right now, if you had to guess this moment.
I'm going with Spotlight. I just think Revenant, there's going to be, maybe I'm totally wrong on this, but Inarritu, Backlash, people who think it's too macho, that kind of thing. Spotlight, though it's nobody, seems to be favorite. I think it'll be the one that people have least issue with.
I think it's a safe choice. I would go with Revenant myself personally, just because Sarah's going to disagree with me on that. But Mike, what's your thought on that?
My personal opinion, I think when you're trying to predict an Oscar winner, I think Spotlight is just lined up, ready for the spotlight. No pun intended. I mean, it's a movie that they think is a message movie that matters.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Putting a movie about this topic on the stage, and I think it hits enough of the right categories. So.
Sure.
Here's why The Revenant and Mad Max don't win. Mm-hmm. They don't have screenplay nominations.
Right.
It's virtually impossible to win Best Picture without a screenplay nomination.
Okay, so what's your spit
shot? I'm going to say that the upset is The Big Short.
Come on.
It's got the bigger name cast. It's got the bigger box office, and people look at it as more influential as to what's happening politically right now. And it's going to win SAG.
Oh, you think so?
I do.
Interesting. Real quick on that, also, this past couple of weeks, we've had a few passings of some individuals of importance. Alan Rickman and David Bowie. Thoughts?
Totally sad.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking in, I think, oddly similar if different ways. I mean, they're both 69.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Both cancer.
Bowie had just released the album a couple days before. Black Star had released a new album.
Genius.
A week had released an album about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Seemed to be finally kind of working again after a long time away, not touring anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of all of a sudden. And I guess Alan Rickman, I'm sure if you, not even gossip rags, maybe if you lived in England, you knew stuff more about how he was sick, but it was a total unknown.
He kept that very, very quiet. Yeah.
And that was a heartbreaker because I think people love their villains and they love their softies, and Rickman managed to kind of play a bit of both over the years. You had Galaxy Quest and Hitchhiker's Guide and Sense and Sensibility, where he kind of plays this lovable guy who just can't quite get it together as a bit of a sad sack, and he's played some phenomenal, you know, arch nemesis.
Quickly Down Under, Die Hard,
Die Hard,
Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, he did it all. A couple weeks ago, we talked about the Danish Girl, so everybody knows where I was coming from on that as far as my own transgender experience. Mm-hmm. David Bowie was hard for me because one of the quintessential films for me growing up that made me realize who I was and what journey I was on was Labyrinth.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons my name is Sarah. It partially came from that film.
The power of voodoo. Who do you do?
Exactly. You remind me of the babe.
Wow.
That movie is one of the quintessential films for me growing up. It's very near and dear to my heart.
And David
Bowie's music,
to
same thing. Yeah. I mean, that's how I was drawn into his music. That one hurt. But Alan Rickman, I grew up with. I mean, Alan Rickman was one of the reasons I fell in love with film. I mean, sitting there watching Die Hard as a little kid in that theater, knowing I wasn't really supposed to be watching it, and seeing him do what he was doing, just fantastic stuff.
Yeah. Mike, any thoughts?
I just echo most everything that was said about their greatness in their own unique way. And I would encourage everybody to listen to the new Bowie record.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether he's with us or not, that record is genius.
I will say, so good. On the surface, it can be a hard listen. It's sort of an acquired taste. It's going to take a listen or two before.
It's almost like fragments of his life just getting tossed into one big musical stew. But hang with it, and wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So things we're working on outside of this, Mike, you've obviously compiled the list, and we can find your list at shouldiseeit.net.
Yes, that's where it is. The Seattle Film Awards, all 3 years of our poll, nominees and winners are there, and I'm reviewing movies every week there, and potentially working on a Film Critics Society sort of project thing. Then, yeah, what is it?
We should have an announcement. Yeah.
And
couple...
The Boy. We're going to have a long conversation about The Boy, doll movie.
Oh,
most definitely.
Brian, how about yourself? What you working on?
I got two things. I started my new masterpieces series because I feel like being the prick who gets to declare what the masterpieces are. So I'm going to try to do one a month. I did one on Zodiac, the terrific Fincher film.
Good choice.
And then I have a new Was I Nuts for Tim Hall specifically because he likes me talking about the old movies coming in the next few days.
What movie?
I was going to keep it under wraps, but I'll just say it. I'm doing So I Married an Axe Murder, which I have no idea people love, but people named Zitzelman in the 90s loved.
Janet. Da-da-da-da.
I'm very interested to see if this movie actually has any fan base.
So last week I actually interviewed the three of the contractors that were in Benghazi.
Oh, wow.
And that interview is up on moviefreak.com and also at Seattle Gay News. This week I will have an interview up with Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson for Animalisa. And I found that I ended up scoring this interview the day of the Oscar nominations. I interviewed Andrew Haig for 45 years.
Well,
I got to talk
played.
To him about Charlotte Rampling's Best Actress nomination hours after he learned about it.
So deserved.
That will be up on moviefreak.com next Friday.
Excellent. So lots to look forward to. And thank you again for taking a listen to us here on Cinema Squabble. You can find us at cinemasquabble.com. For Sarah Michelle Fetters, Brian Zitzelman, Mike Ward, and our producer, Sprints Arbogast, thanks much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.